From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with the author Gary Kowalski. I will go to that archived interview now, and you will hear my introduction to our conversation. The recording's going to sound a little bit different because it was recorded at a different time in a different place. But anyway, I hope you enjoy our conversation from 2013. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the Reverend Gary Kowalski, author of best-selling books on animals, nature, history, and spirituality. A graduate of Harvard College and the Harvard Divinity School, his work has been translated into German, French, Spanish, Japanese, Chinese, and Czech. It's appeared in periodicals like Tikkun and Yoga Journal, and his work has been voted a reader's favorite by the Quality Paperback Book Club. Whether investigating the emotional lives of other species, demystifying the faith of America's founding fathers, unpacking the Bible, or pondering the frontiers of modern physics, Gary's work centers on the connection of spirit and nature, acknowledging our kinship with each other and with a universe that is passionate, evolving, and alive. Gary Kowalski has been on the show once before. At that time, which I believe was in 2008, or it could have been 9, we talked about his book, Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers. He is also the author of The Souls of Animals, Science and the Search for God, The Bible According to Noah, Theology as if Animals Mattered, Earth Day, an alphabet book, and the two books that we discussed for this broadcast. First, Blessings of the Animals, and then Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Ever Lost a Pet. Gary Kowalski has served Unitarian Universalist churches in Vermont, Washington, Tennessee, New Mexico, and Massachusetts, where he is presently, I believe, the minister at the First Unitarian Church of Worcester. When we spoke by phone last month, I began by asking Gary if he has a favorite story about animals from the Bible or from another spiritual text.
Well, there are lots of great stories, but one of my favorite stories that I share in my book Goodbye Friend comes from the ancient Hindu scriptures, from the Mahabharata, which is one of the great epics of the Indian subcontinent. It's about 3,000 years old, and it's an enormously long and complicated book, but in essence it's a hero's journey. And the hero of this epic, Euhisthira, is on a quest for wisdom, enlightenment, bliss, eternal life. And he's finally come to the end of his lengthy pilgrimage. He's made it to the heights of the highest mountains in the Himalayas. He's scaled the summits. And all his traveling companions, his brothers, have dropped away, weighted down by the accumulated baggage of their karmic debts and sins. But Euhisthira is a hero who is pure and upright and blameless, a man of righteous heart and noble intent. And so he's able to make it to the gates of paradise. Uh-huh. And there he meets Indra, who's the king of the gods. And Indra says to him, "Well done, Euhisthira. You've made it all the way here to the pearly gates, or their Indian equivalent. And so now we're ready to welcome you into the realm of immortal bliss. But Euhisthira, I see you have a dog with you, and I have to tell you that we don't allow dogs in heaven." And Euhisthira says, "Well, my dog has been with me for this entire journey. He's shared all my hardships. He's been with me through all of my adventures. He's been loyal, faithful, companionable. I can't possibly abandon this animal. that would be wrong. And Indra, the king of the gods, says, well, you Histhura, dogs are not worthy of paradise. A rule is a rule. You're going to have to leave your dog behind. And at this point, Euhisthira, the hero, says, well, if that's the rule, I'm going to forego my own opportunity to share in the bliss of heaven. Me and my dog are sticking together, so you can keep heaven for yourself. And at this point, this was just the final test. This was the final ordeal to measure the mettle of Euhisthira's character. And at this point, the dog turns into a god. The dog's name is Savana, which in Sanskrit means dog, and the dog becomes the dog star, and you know, is elevated up into the celestial realms of perfection and wholeness and peace. And so both man and mutt enter into the realm of bliss. And you know, I love that story, one, because it's so old, and two, because the truths, I think, are so deeply felt by anyone who's ever shared their life with an animal. You know, if you leave out the mythical, legendary elements, what's it saying? It's saying that you know, in this sense of companionship, affection, unconditional love, this is where we have a little foretaste of heaven. If we have any sense of bliss and delight, it's to be found here in our connection with our animal friends. So it's a great story.
I love that. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, and so many people feel that way. You know, I think Will Rogers, when he was near the end of his life, said he didn't know if there was a heaven or what was in the afterlife, but he wanted to go where the dogs go.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I remember being a kid, and I was raised Catholic, and I just remember that there was this basic understanding that dogs didn't have souls and dogs wouldn't go to heaven, and it was like, really? Like, why? You know?
Yeah,
makes absolutely no sense.
It seems to me that dogs have very large and deep and gracious and generous souls compared to some people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, in olden times, this idea of soul, there was no gap or gulf between the souls of animals and the souls of humankind. If you go back to the book of Genesis, the second chapter, it says, you know, God made Adam and put Adam in the garden and saw that Adam was alone, lacked a companion, and so the Creator fashioned the animals to be partners and playmates for the first human. And in Hebrew it says that God endowed the animals with nefesh chayim. The Hebrew basically means a living soul, and then it uses the same term. It says God also, this is also what God gave to Adam, nefesh chayim. So, you know, it's the same word. And then, like 2,500 years later, when they got around to making the King James Version, the English translators would change that, and they'd, for the case of the animal, they'd say God made the animals living creatures, but Adam a living soul. So, you know, over the course of centuries and millennia, this chasm widened between the spirit of the animals and the spirit of the human. But for ancient peoples, there was no such distinction. It was the soul, the spirit, was just this mysterious essence of life, of vitality, that all creatures shared, including the human.
Oh, I love that. That's wonderful to know. One of the two books we're talking about today is called Blessings of the Animals, Celebrating Our Kinship with All Creation. And early in the book, you talk about the actual Blessing of the Animals ceremony that your congregation organizes from time to time. So first, I wondered if you could say where your congregation is and what it's called, and then if you could talk about the Blessing of the Animals ceremony and why you do it.
Well, I've been celebrating animal blessings for most of the 30 years that I've been a minister.
Oh, you have? Okay.
20 of those years I spent as the minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Society in Burlington, Vermont.
Right.
And currently I'm serving a congregation in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
So I've also done animal blessings in Sudbury, Massachusetts, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. So it's a movable feast, and it's movable in terms of time as well as in location. You can do an animal blessing at any time of the year. Earth Day is a favorite time. Some Jewish congregations have gotten into the act and do these around a holiday called the New Year for Trees, which falls in early spring, kind of a celebration of the earth. But
what is that called? Do you remember?
It's called Tu B'Shvat.
Tu B'Shvat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most Christian churches celebrate these around the feast day of Saint Francis in early October.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a long history. They go back way before Saint Francis. Rome in January, they do a animal blessing every year for Saint Anthony the Abbot, who's like a fourth century Christian saint and the patron saint of pigs and other barnyard animals. So you know, it's been happening at that chapel for a very long time.
Wow. So what do you do? What is the Blessing of the Animals ceremony like?
Yeah, well, it's always a lot of fun. We invite people, kids, families to bring their pets, you know. And we've had dogs and cats and parrots and tortoises and lots of guinea pigs and rats and rodents. And one time someone brought a jar of earthworms. And in my book about blessings of the animals, I have a chapter on earthworms and
your daughter had them as pets, right? Or
That's right. My daughter has a tub full of earthworms in the student co-op where she lives. But they're always just great fun. You know, the first time we did this, my church had just done a big renovation of the building and spent about $40,000 on new carpet, and people were a little worried about, you know, a bunch of dogs coming in. But really the dogs are the best behaved members of the church in general. And it's a great deal of fun. And of course, if some people who are listening may know about the Dog Chapel in Vermont too. The dog chapel was a creation of the artist Stephen Hunick, who created all these adorable prints of canine characters, but then constructed this little New England style meeting house, white clappered little steeple on his property there at Dog Mountain outside St. Johnsbury. And you know, it's celebration of the animals year round. Every day is blessing of the animals there. Mm-hmm. He's got stained glass windows with pictures of pups, and you know, there's inscriptions of canine virtues, love, loyalty, fidelity, and so forth. And at the ends of the pews, they're hand-carved. He was a great craftsman. You know, they're hand-carved dogs in a sitting position. So it's a wonderful place, and the whole entry has in the past been covered with photographs of pets who are gone, tributes to departed pets that people have been sent in. So,
okay, all right. Yeah. That that reminds me of a part of the book. Speaking of pets that have passed on, you write about Sally Linder and her. She's an artist, and she did she worked up a tribute to the Philadelphia Zoo primates that had died in a fire. And she created this work,
right,
of celebration.
Right.
Can you just talk about that a little tiny
bit? Yeah. Back in 1995, there was a terrible fire in the Philadelphia Zoo. It was on Christmas morning, and there were 23 animals who died in the fire, including gorillas, orangutans, lemurs, and gibbons, you know, whole families of animals, including very young ones. I think the youngest was a little gorilla who was just 11 months old. Apparently it was a problem with the wiring in the building, but when the zoo staff came in the morning, all of these animals were dead from smoke inhalation and asphyxiation, which was just devastating for the people who had worked with them, and really devastating for many others too, to think of such a waste of life. Sally, as you mentioned, is a gifted and internationally recognized artist. Sally was moved to create a tribute to these animals. She contacted the curator of the zoo and did individual portraits of each of the animals that had died, and they are magnificent. They're just beautiful. Sally says, as she painted these animals, she became so intimate with them that they came alive. She could smell them in her studio as she was painting. Their spirits were manifest to her. And as she contacted me, this was the first time I'd met her, I said I was serving as the minister of the Unitarian Church in Burlington, Vermont, and Sally contacted me because she had arranged a showing of these portraits, a one-week exhibition. They were going to be shown in an empty storefront that was located downtown. I think the space had been at like a retail clothing store, and she'd talked with the real estate developer and gotten permission to use this space as a tribute to these animals, but she wanted in some way to sanctify or to consecrate the space, and she didn't know me, but she knew I'd done blessing ceremonies and written about animals, so she called me as a clergy person to come in and say a prayer and hallow this exhibition space, to turn it from, you know, a commercial to a sacred use.
Yeah, actually, in the book, you talk about speaking. Do you mind if I read? That's the paragraph I was going to read, and I was going to ask you to talk about it. I just loved this paragraph.
Yeah.
You say, "I can't remember what I said, because that's the reality of what ministers do. Prayers, sermons, words of counsel, blessing, and admonition are all ephemera, like performance art. They are intended to address a moment in passing, whether a birth, a wedding, a loss, or some other transient episode in life's drama. As shamans in our own right, we clergy attempt to single out these incidents to be hallowed before they become lost and forgotten, reabsorbed in time's ceaseless flow." I thought that was really a lovely paragraph, and it really made sense to me that would be what it must be like to speak about these sorts of events.
Well, it is, and the remarkable thing is that while clergy are involved in something like performance art, singling out these passing moments and making them special in some way, Sally decided that her own work also had this this passing transitory quality, because she created these portraits in honor, in memoriam, mm-hmm. to the animals who had died, but then she wasn't sure what to do with them after they'd shown for 1 week. She sat with what she calls a grandmother's council, a circle of wise women, where they spent time drumming and spent time in silence. And finally, she says, it came to her that what the primates themselves wanted, what the animals themselves wanted, was to be remembered. And Sally took this in the sense of being remembered, reintegrated, rejoined to the natural world, to the habitat, the environment in which their species had evolved over the course of thousands and millions of years. And so she embarked on this really, really amazing quest to take these portraits, which are big, you know, they're like 4 or 5 feet on a side.
Oh,
when,
yeah.
when she's painting the gorillas, the gibbons, the orangutans, the creatures are life size. So she embarked on a journey to take these back to Cameroon for the gorillas, to Madagascar for the lemurs, to Borneo for the orangutans, right, all over the world, back to the jungles. And she contacted various wildlife organizations to see who might be working in these areas, who could assist her with the project. And mostly she got turned down, or she got the response of, well, you know, what you're doing is crazy, you silly woman. Why don't you just, you know, if you're concerned about animals, why don't you just sell these portraits? They're nice artwork. You could probably fetch a good sum and then, you know, give the money to some conservation organization like us, for instance. That was not Sally's intent. She felt that all of their lives, these animals had been used. They had been made the vehicles of, you know, human use, entertainment, exhibition, education, if you want to say that zoos have an educational function, but their life had never been their own. And in death, she was determined to break this cycle of using the animals one last time. So she wasn't going to sell these portraits or profit from them in any way. The animals had to be set free, and she did finally find assistance with the World Wildlife Fund, which just happened to be working in all of the areas that she needed to go, and helped put her into touch with the indigenous tribes people who inhabited these areas, because Sally wanted to make sure that her own artistic vision was consonant with the cultural values of the people living in that environment. And so Sally says she was able to make contact with all of the people, and although none of them spoke English, through interpreters and through her own, you know, drawings and signs, she was able to communicate her intent, which surprisingly or not surprisingly, these indigenous and what we would call, you know, primitive people understood. They understood her wish to honor these animals in death. When I say primitive, some of these people, you know, they were living without any modern conveniences, no electricity, no appliances or what we would consider contact with the civilized world. In fact, one of the tribes, although they were sculptors, and Sally showed me some of the work that they carved with their knives just in a matter of minutes for her. Incredible craftspeople, but they'd never seen or encountered two-dimensional artworks in all their years. And when Sally showed them these fantastic portraits that were so realistic, just vibrant with life, they were shocked. They were awed. They had never seen two-dimensional artworks. And for a time, they rifled through the sheets of paper, looking underneath each sheet. So, you know, how could you compress a three-dimensional image under this flat surface? And then finally they caught the trick and rubbed their hands all over the surface of the image, and then rubbed their hands across their bodies to transfer the magic, which I thought was just great. You know, the whole thing kind of gives me goosebumps when I think about this, when I talk about this. What an amazing person that Sally is. You know, she's an artist in the sense of a seer, a prophet, a visionary, and making this quest. But that's where the primates ended up.
It's almost as though the people that didn't want to help her were too sophisticated to understand what she wanted to do. She had to get to the place where people were going to look at it more as magic,
it was a more primal understanding of our relationship to other creatures and to the earth, right?
Yeah, it's almost sad. It's almost like in our technological savvy, we've lost track of what that is, you know, to be primal, I guess.
Yeah, the primates were remembered as she wished. You know, they were remembered the way that a falling leaf is remembered into the forest floor, the way that a drop is remembered into the great ocean when it falls into the sea. And it's a beautiful, touching story. So usually animal blessings, as I said, are happy occasions, but that was one of the more unusual blessings that was a little more somber.
I wanted to ask you about another essay in the book, which I guess sort of corresponds to this idea of sort of the magical, or you say in this essay that you don't necessarily believe in signs, but you do believe in wonders. You talk about having seen a mother mallard and three ducklings on the morning that you heard about the death of the author Robert McCluskey, who of course wrote Make Way for Ducklings in addition to many other wonderful children's books. So that was a wonderful moment in the book, reading about your experience. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about wonders and I don't know, maybe spiritual coincidence and what that, how you interpret that.
Right. Well, you know, some people would say maybe that is just coincidental. Perhaps I'd seen ducks walking across the road before. Apparently it's not unusual. McCluskey based his story Make Way for Ducklings on a true incident. You know, I'm down in Massachusetts now, and the Boston Animal Rescue League says every spring it's going to happen. There's going to be some little ducklings who fall through a grate that their mother can walk over and find themselves in some kind of trouble. So ducks and traffic have been interacting in problematic ways as at least as long as we've had streets full of cars. So okay. McCluskey, was observing something that was not all that unusual.
Okay.
And as I did a little research, you know, one of the things I like about writing is doing research and trying to get the backstory. Apparently, well, if you know the book, the illustrations are just charming. That's at least as much as the story. But apparently, as an artist, McCluskey found it very difficult to draw these birds. I mean, how do you draw a duck? You usually can't get that close to them, and they don't hold still. He tried sketching them in museums, but they were stuffed and lifeless and posed, and that was no good. Finally, he was living in Greenwich Village at the time with another artist, and they got some ducks and put them in the apartment, in the bathroom at the apartment where they were living, but they were still moving too fast, splashing around in the bathtub. So they were young at that time and unknown, but they had enough money for some cheap jug wine, so they shared their wine with the ducks and made them drowsy enough to slow down and let their portraits be drawn. So if those ducks in McCloskey's book look a little tipsy, that's the reason why.
That's why.
I believe in everyday wonders and everyday miracles. And, you know, it's a fact that the ducks walking across the street, people will stop, and they get a police escort. So I share other stories from newspapers more recently where similar incidents have happened. And, you know, the police, the aid car, the fireman, whoever's needed comes to the rescue. And it's nice to think that our species can slow down and appreciate, you know, that this is a little miracle of nature.
I've seen cows crossing the road here in Vermont, but I haven't seen the mother leading the ducklings across the road. So I hope to see that someday.
Well, they do. You know, there's a they go from Lake Champlain over to the wetlands, and they've got to cross some major arteries to get there, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I want to move on and talk a little bit about your other book that we have here today, which is Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Ever Lost a Pet, which of course is so many of us have been through this. The first sentence of the book is Everything Dies, which really grounds the reader in reality. And then you go on to talk about pets, and that the word pet is associated both with things that are sort of insignificant or petty, as well as things that are cherished. So I wondered if we could begin by talking a little bit about why people sometimes worry that they'll seem silly for mourning a creature like a pet, and why we do that to ourselves.
Well, we don't get much support for mourning or bereavement in our culture at all. You know, 100 years ago, it was common when a death occurred that people would wear mourning clothes, a black armband or something, 6 months for a sibling or 2 years for a life partner. And now it's like, you know, you may get a sympathy card, but once the funeral's done, if there is a funeral, it's like, okay, get up and you know, suck it up and get about your business. So I don't think there's a lot of sympathy or understanding out there in general, and it's because, well, we're uncomfortable with the topic of mortality. Like you said, you know, the first sentence of my book, Everything Dies, it's good to get it out there because you can't really hide it. But there's even less support in the case of a pet. And that's changing. You know, when I wrote this book has come out within the past year in a new, enlarged, revised edition. But the original edition came out in 1997.
Okay.
And back then there wasn't much out there at all on this topic. There's more now, and I think people are being sensitized to the fact that animals matter, but you will still get, you know, comments in the attitude of it's just a dog, it's just a cat, get over it, move on. But, you know, of course, animals, we have especially close and tender bonds with animals. I think that the relationship with an animal, because it's so direct, it's so immediate, It's unmediated by language, even. Mm-hmm. Because the love is so pure, the grief is often especially intense when these creatures die, and so it hits us very hard.
Right, and unlike children who grow up and become independent, and you know, ideally, you know, have their own lives, animals always need us, and so the loss of them is just like, you know, you feel like you're so responsible for this creature forever.
I share the account of Iris Muggenthaler, who is a great animal lover. Iris lives in Vermont. She was, you know, my neighbor for many years, but she told me about her horse, and horses live a long time. 30, 40 years is a normal lifespan for a horse. So when she was an adolescent, a teenager, she got this animal and named the horse Sentimental Journey. Iris is older, you know, that was the name of a popular big band tune back when she was young. But she was in her mid-40s then when the animal died. So, you know, she came of age, spent the prime of her life with this horse. And she said that it not to discount the death of her parents at all, but the horse's loss hit her even harder than the loss of her mom and dad, because in the case of the horse, it was daily contact. You know, you're exercising the animal, feeding, watering, grooming, cleaning. It's very hands-on. It's very tactile. And it's just something you don't find anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the subjects that you write about in the book is the difficult choice to euthanize a pet. I'm wondering if your parishioners express a lot of guilt about making this choice, or do you pick up on a sense of relief afterward from the people that you speak with? Or
well, I get just recently I got a message. You know, I have a website. I'm not pushing my website here, but it's www.kowalskibooks.com, and I have a contact form there. So, you know, about once a week or so, somebody will write me, and a woman indeed was, you know, just feeling great guilt, concern. Had she done the right thing? It's a very difficult decision, you know. Mm-hmm. But in almost every case I've encountered, it's done with the best of intentions to spare the animal prolonged suffering. In some cases, to spare it an anguished and painful death is the last gift that we can. That we can give, and
right.
You know, this is an act of life and of love. So there's inevitably sadness, but I don't think there should be any guilt accompanying that.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know sometimes, you know, how the animal is feeling, because we can't use words, and we're not sure if animals feel the same kind of emotional distress and worry that we do when we come to the end of life. You know, my dog Chinook was 11 when he lost the use of his rear legs, and he was a big dog. At that point, he helped us make the decision that we needed to let him go. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he was. I don't think he was feeling worried about anything at that point. So it just became both a necessity and a kindness for him. And, you know, people focus too much energy, too, on the last moment or the last minutes of a creature's life. They do this with their family members too. You know, they worry, oh, I wasn't there at the moment when Grandpa died, but you know, you need to look at the whole life. It's not the death that imparts meaning to existence. It's the long life of love and friendship and companionship and adventure. So try to keep it in perspective.
Right, absolutely. And you hear a lot of stories too about people who are sick in the hospital or something, and they tend to pass away. I don't know if this is always true, but you know, sometimes they tend to pass away when everybody's left the room. You know, it's almost
That's what Kubler-Ross said, and yeah. You know, that the final stage of dying is this stage of withdrawal.
Yeah.
After you've done your bargaining and your denial and your anger, you've accepted the reality that you're going to die, and as you come close to the end, she said, you withdraw, you retreat. You've said what needs to be said, you've done what needs to be done. There's nothing more except to go into yourself, and at that point it becomes an inner journey. It's between you and the great mystery, which is how I regard it. You know, I love the last words of a 19th century preacher, New England preacher, Henry Ward Beecher. He was on his deathbed, and last words are always interesting. You know, what are people going to say there at the final moment? His last words were, "And now the mystery." I like that, you know, because it shows a lot of hope, faith, confidence, curiosity, what's next, but also, you know, a willingness not to know, a willingness to let it be. So I think in my best moments, that's my attitude.
Yeah, absolutely. For people who are listening, I just want to mention a couple parts of this book that I thought would be just so helpful. One is a bulleted list of suggestions for helping children cope with the loss of a pet, which I thought was just perfect, because I think that would be hard to explain, particularly when we're grieving on our own, to explain to our children what's going on. And then the other part is, at the end of the book, you include a selection of readings and poems on life and death, which are just wonderful and probably help people who might want to come up with the right thing to say at a ceremony, you know, if you have a little ceremony for a pet who has died. So I guess I'm just thanking you for putting those in. I found them really interesting to read.
For me, poetry is one of the things that helps me at a time of loss. I mean, it's a point where ordinary words fail, that's what poetry are. They're extraordinary words. You know, most of the Bible I look on as poetry, so it can be helpful, and other scriptures may be helpful, but other poems too. You know, like Wendell Berry. I think I include him in that collection. The Peace of Wild Things. Mm. You know, a few years ago, I just memorized some of my favorite poems, like that one, because, I don't know. They're like little touchstones. I can carry them around that way and refer to them and pull them out when I need them. I don't know where else to turn. You know, so I hope people will use the poems in that way to find some wisdom and guidance when they need it.
Yeah, it's a good idea to memorize something so beautiful.
It is.
You can
It's nice to have some special passages that you call your own.
Yeah, absolutely. Gary, I was going to ask you, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm a working parish minister, so I'm always writing sermons, and many of my books grow out of my work as a clergyman, like the book on blessing of the animals. And
okay,
yeah. So who knows what will come next? Now the mystery.
Yeah. Right. One last question for you. I enjoyed your suggestion that people who are dealing with grief might write a letter. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about writing as a means of navigating grief.
Absolutely. Well, I share in my book my own experience that writing a eulogy or a memoir or a remembrance can be a very therapeutic and cathartic act. You know, it's the truth is that sometimes I don't know exactly how I'm feeling until I try to articulate it. Mm. I mean, maybe you've had this experience. I certainly have. That I'll be speaking and think that I'm in perfect control of myself and in command of my subject. But if it's something personal and intimate and perhaps somewhat painful, I'll find myself suddenly, you know, getting a little lump in my throat, or maybe yeah. getting misty-eyed, having to catch myself. For a moment I lose my voice, and mm-hmm. it's interesting because that sometimes takes me by surprise. It's like I hadn't seen it coming. The emotion just rises up unexpectedly, and there it is. And I think grief is like that. That oftentimes we don't know what is tumbling around inside us until we try to articulate it and let it out. And you know, grief isn't one emotion. Grief is the whole constellation of reactions that we have when someone who's near and dear or a pet dies. It can be numbness and shock and sadness and panic and guilt and regret, but it can also be have an element of gratitude and celebration and even euphoria. It's just a jumble.
Right.
But I think by putting the words on paper, we begin to bring all those feelings into our conscious awareness, and they seem more manageable then. And by the act of writing, I think we focus on the significant details, and we begin to take what, you know, has been a lifetime and turn it into a narrative that has a beginning and a middle and an end. And putting life into story form is often how we make meaning of our experience. So it's very helpful. And I recommend that people, after they've written, that they speak their eulogy aloud, even if, you know, you can have a memorial service, and you should have some kind of memorial service when your animal dies.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you don't, you should say these words aloud. You know, grief has to be full-throated. It needs to be aired and given voice. So statements like "I love you" and "I'll miss you," these need to be articulated and given full expression.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done lots of eulogies as a clergyman, but some of the hardest were for my own family members. I did my granddad's eulogy back
right.
in the 80s. I did my mother's 5 years ago. I did the services when my wife's parents died, and it's always difficult to speak personally about those you care about. But
mm-hmm.
for me personally, those have also been, you know, cleansing and healing experiences, to be able to offer that kind of tribute.
Yeah. And It's funny because I suspect you're the kind of person, just speaking to you now, I feel like you're the kind of person who can speak relatively easily without sitting down and writing something out first. Is that correct?
No. I always write it out. I'm getting better. You know, I can speak with you in a conversation and an interview, but I always write things down.
Yeah, okay.
And they say that for good writers, writing is harder than for other people. So I struggle with it. I try to find just the right words.
I want to just mention the names of the books again. Blessings of the Animals, Celebrating Our Kinship with All Creation, is published by Lantern Books. And Goodbye Friend, Healing Wisdom for Anyone Who Has Ever Lost a Pet, the revised edition is published by New World Library. Thank you so much, Gary, for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP. Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I hope you enjoyed that conversation from 2013 with the author Gary Kowalski. You can learn more about his work at his website, kowalskibooks.com. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Oh, and also at my website, you'll see information about my book giveaway. It's at the top, there's a tab labeled hashtag book giveaway. That's at shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.